To me, David is someone who makes big puppets, because I'm an art and actions person. Or he's dancing with Ronald Reagan Home for the Criminally Insane. And he's got it all right, and I'm doing the wrong step. So then Jeff Gubler makes me go film it, because I'm not dancing right. But it started with WTO, and that's what David's going to tell us about. David, soulmate, with no further ado.
Thank you. Thanks to Indie Bay for having me here. Thanks to the Continental Club. And I think I know I'm getting old when people ask me to talk about things that happened 10 years ago, but in my perspective, that was a warm-up for what needs to happen in the future. So I was going to talk a little bit about the birth of indie media and the political moment that came out of. And there's an amazing film that folks in Buenos Aires Indie Media made about the birth of indie media. And I'm going to show a clip of it in a little bit. But the fact that, almost 11 years ago, tens of thousands of people shut down the WTO in Seattle, folks know the story. But the fact that a bunch of folks made a conscious decision that they weren't going to lock down with stick their arms in tubes, they weren't going to be medics, they weren't going to cook food, they weren't going to do childcare. They were going to take pictures and write stories and hang out on the internet and post them. The fact that that happened was actually key to why that particular shutdown was successful. So I'm here today to show respect and honor to all those people who 11 years ago and since then made conscious decisions that they were going to take on the role of doing media, because without that, our movements will get their asses kicked. So much love to Indie Bay and to all the indie media makers in the house. We've got AK Press, The Commentator, KPFA, Homes Not Jail, Slingshot, Poor News, who else? What other media makers do we have in the house?
Commemorator,
Black Panther Party.
West Coast.
Leaf.
PM Press.
One more time.
PM
Press. Who else?
Poor News Network.
LA Indie Media.
LA Indie Media in the house.
Yeah. Uhuru News, Burning
Spear. Uhuru News, Burning Spear. So thank you everyone for being independent media makers and making an end run around the corporate media so we can succeed. So I did a book called Army of None a little bit, trying to figure out how to fight military recruiters, because after the Iraq War started, a bunch of us were like, all right, we don't have a strategy to stop the war once it started, so let's figure out a strategy. We tried to figure out how can we starve them of soldiers being recruited. So I looked into, well, how do they recruit people? Because the problem governments always have with wars is, how do you get people to fight them and the public to support them? And the way they do that is through propaganda, through telling stories. And I'm going to talk a little bit about storytelling, because that's what I think media makers are, is they're people who tell stories and amplify stories. And as a direct action organizer, I think our actions are also stories. And that if we want to fight and win changes in the world, we have to understand our opponent's stories, be able to expose them, call them out. But that's not enough. If we just say their story is wrong, we still are not going to win. We have to actually become compelling storytellers ourselves and figure out how to tell our own narratives. And a lot of our problems right now in this country is we're good at critiquing the opponent's stories, but we don't have our own. So I'll just jump back a little bit. During World War I, there was a huge working class movement, anarchists, socialists, pacifists, IWWs, all these radical movements that when the U.S. started doing the drumbeat to war against Germany, they're like, hell no, we're not going to fight a bunch of working class folks just like us for a bunch of rich people. And so they needed a way to compel people, to get people to think that it was a good idea. So President Woodrow Wilson created a Committee on Public Information, and he got the nephew of this guy, Edward Bernays. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He was a psychologist. And asked him to be part of this committee and figure out how the hell do we get people to support the war? Because there's all kinds of, you know, popular mass movements that were winning all over the country, and people were against the war. So they put Edward Bernays and they asked him to come up with a public relations campaign, and he said he could do it. And so what he did is he demonized the Germans, called them Huns, did a huge PR campaign, got people scared about the German menace, and it worked. In about 6 months, not all, but they shifted significant public opinion to where enough people supported the war that they could actually enter World War I. And that also, that turn of public opinion allowed them to crack down on those people who continued to oppose it, which was the Palmer raids, mass deportation of immigrant organizers, shutdowns of the IWW and radical labor offices all over the country. And Edward Bernays used his psychological analysis of the human brain, and he actually developed what's used today when people sell Kellogg's Corn Flakes, when the military recruits young people, when the German Nazi Party tries to persuade their folks, and it's called public relations or propaganda. He was trying to turn it into a legitimate professional career. His book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, was used by the Nazi propagandist Goebbels in creating the propaganda campaign for the Nazi Party. And he said, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, it is now possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing it. And so that campaign for World War I initiated and sort of professionalized modern propaganda, usually amplified through mainstream and corporate media. And I would argue that since that time, we've been in primarily an information war, a war over stories. And so we have to figure out how to fight that war more effectively. In the 2003 invasion in Iraq, the government used probably the most audacious level of information warfare. They just repeated big lies over and over again. They told us they linked September 11th with Iraq, claimed there were stockpiles of nuclear weapons, actually fabricated news stories. They created a fake toppling of Saddam's statue that was completely fabricated for the media. Or if folks remember the stage rescue of Jessica Lynch, the U.S. Army woman, they staged a rescue as a propaganda spectacle. So they've become very skilled at creating spectacles and persuading people. They also created a lot of memes. I don't know if folks are familiar with memes, but there's a group called Smart Meme that's popularized the term a little bit more, but it's any kind of a concept like War on Terror or Coca-Cola, where I say those words and you have a whole narrative that goes into your head. And so there's two kinds of memes. There's control memes, which are the memes that they come up with, like War on Terror, which for a lot of people has a whole narrative that makes them think a whole bunch of stuff. And then there's what we call smart memes, which are our counter narratives, where we try and create alternatives. And so trying to figure out how to fight a meme warfare war. And there's our War on Terror, things like calling the war Operation Iraqi Freedom, which was initially Operation Iraqi Oil, or Operation Iraqi Liberation, until I realized it spelled oil. One of the things I was, when I was researching the book, I'll just jump back. One of the powerful things in Seattle was the fact that people were very self-organized, and folks looking back at it analyzed that the reason we won the Seattle police is because we were a decentralized movement that was self-organized, and the police were a hierarchical movement that was centrally organized. So on the street, we were actually more flexible, had better information, and so one on that level. And since that time, and jumping back to a lot of other struggles, kicking off with the Zapatista uprising, the government's been researching how do people organize in networks and how do we understand that. And they've actually, in the last 10 or 15 years, completely analyzed horizontal network organizing and the information and media wars that go along with that. They call it net war. And the RAND Corporation did a study to make recommendations for the U.S. military. They looked about 15 years at, well into the future, 2025, and what they came up with is came up with five plausible scenarios of here's what the world could look like in 2025, and here's what the U.S. military needs to do to succeed. One of those, their worst, next to worst case scenario, the worst case scenario of these plausible futures was chaos and anarchy. The one next to it was called transnational web, which sort of sounds like a victory of our social movements. They called it our medium bad world, and to quote them, represents a more unorthodox view of the 2025 future that posits a situation in which the nation state has lost a substantial amount of power to transnational actors. Many of whom use the burgeoning internet to coordinate their actions worldwide much more rapidly than could any national government bureaucracy. And they create a fictitious situation where an organization called the World Environmental League is spearheading a crusade to compel the UN General Assembly to approve a radical treaty for fossil fuel emission reduction that would cripple many American and Western manufacturing industries. So this is actually what the military is basing themselves on. And they say the World Environmental League engages in militant actions against U.S. and corporations and requires a military response. They call that military response a net war army. And it would be a very robust cyber war and electronic intelligence capability, a crisis public affairs branch to participate in information operations, and teams of special operations forces capable of operating against non-state actors who frequently employ electronic means to wreak damage on state and non-state opponents. So that's what they're preparing for. And I'll just jump back a little bit to the story of Seattle, which actually didn't start in Seattle, and for a lot of us it started in the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas. January 1st, 1994, almost 16 years ago, the people of Chiapas, primarily indigenous people, rose up against the North American Free Trade Agreement, an agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico that said big business and corporations can do whatever they want across borders, and any local, state, or national law that gets in the way is a violation of free trade. The folks in Chiapas said this is a death sentence on indigenous people and campesinos. One of the things it would have overturned is what they fought, in part, the Mexican Revolution for, the ejido system of shared land ownership. That was considered a violation of free trade rules. January 1st, 1994, folks rose up, militarily occupied 14 towns, and I think what was significant is they told a very different story than the traditional left. They weren't trying to take state power. They weren't issuing traditional rhetorical anti-imperialist, down with this, up with that manifestos, but very articulate, compelling, and poetic stories and narratives. And very shortly thereafter, the Mexican military moved 15,000 troops into Chiapas to try and crush this movement. They did two things. They did that, and they tried to block any media access so that nobody could hear the story. The reason those 15,000 troops didn't crush the Zapatistas is because independent media activists using the, at that time, 1994, pretty fresh internet, were able to circumvent the mainstream media and repeat the communiques, translate them, type them up, and send them out, fax them out. And that would stimulate other people to pass it on, which stimulated people doing solidarity marches, candlelight vigils, fax, phone campaigns. So Harry Cleaver calls the Zapatista War, the Zapatista circumventing that mainstream media and directly connecting with people around the planet who had shared values, that the electronic fabric of struggle, that they were weaving a new way of struggle. And so, you know, while they had some military elements, they also had laptops in the Lacandon jungle where they would type stuff up, get it to allies who would translate it, circulate it, and that happened over and over. So there was a huge amount of information that circumvented, you know, what 10 years ago would have been potentially a crushed movement, and created enough political pressure that the Mexican government didn't use those 15,000 troops to the extent they could have to crush the movement. And so it was through that, those independent media activists using, ironically, the same internet that had been created by the military for military communications, and since then has been used by global capitalism to shift speculative finance around the world. That was how they were able to survive and not just sustain the rebellion in Chiapas, but initiate a new form of rebellion around the world. Exactly 1 year later, on January 1st, 1995, the World Trade Organization was initiated. It came out of the Global Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, which was sort of the post-World War II economic plan about how the elites were going to run the global economy. And they had a plan that had come out of the World Economic Forum, a global gathering of elites called the World Trade Organization. This was their plan about how they were going to further concentrate wealth and power, cut across any kind of limitations that people in local area states or nation states had created on moving their money and extracting wealth from communities. And so exactly 1 year after the Zapatistas rebelled against NAFTA, the prototypical free trade agreement, they inaugurated the WTO. They had a series of meetings in 1998. There was mass demonstrations in Geneva, Switzerland, biggest street actions and riots that Switzerland had seen for decades. In 1999, they decided to meet the United States, and they had actually planned to meet in Denver. So a bunch of folks I was working with said, okay, we're going to mobilize to... they were going to meet in San Diego, so we were planning to meet in San Diego. We figured we'd get all the people from the cold parts of the country to come because it was going to be in December. We'd just send them pictures of sunny beaches and they'd all come, right? So we always figured it was actually a conscious decision to choose the meeting site in cold, wet, northwest in Seattle. And there's a direct lineage of the Zapatista rebellion to the WTO protest in that the Zapatistas invited folks to have encuentros or encounters in Chiapas, hear about their ideas, build a global network of like-minded folks who were resisting neoliberalism or global capitalism. One of these meetings, they did several in Chiapas, and then they had one in Spain in, I believe, 1998. And at that, people realized they needed an ongoing organizational space to coordinate the resistance, particularly against the WTO, but also against other forms of neoliberalism. So they created People's Global Action, which was a global network of radical social movements heavily based in the global south. And so they developed the plans for mass mobilizations against the WTO in Geneva and also against the G8 when it met in both Cologne, Germany and Birmingham in Cologne, Germany in 1999 and Birmingham, England in 1998. And People's Global Action called for International Days of Action, and those were the first coordinated anti-capitalist actions around the world. Reclaim the Streets in England took a lot of leadership. So in 1998, we had one with Reclaim the Streets in Berkeley, right?
I wasn't there.
Okay. I wasn't either. We did one also up in Seattle. So there was a series of Zapatista-initiated coordinations around global days. So when the WTO dates were set, it was actually People's Global Action that called the Day of Action, and there were actions all over the planet, not just in Seattle. I guess I'd like to add a little bit that I've been involved in a lot of direct action campaigns that have done amazing actions but have been blacked out by the media. And what was remarkable about Seattle is that the folks in indie media and all the... probably several hundred people who spent full time taking pictures, writing, and circumventing the corporate media, that actually allowed us to, as the Zapatistas had done, do an end run around the corporate media, get our story out. And, you know, what was amazing about Seattle was not that it was an amazing demonstration. Friends in Bolivia have seen footage of it, and they said, well, that's a normal demonstration. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal was that it was a bunch of people in the rich country, in the United States, showing that there wasn't a consensus, that there wasn't support amongst the people in the U.S. to create a free trade, globalized, concentrated capitalist system. So that was a big deal. I think there's equal needs to do that, both around wars, around climate justice now. I think I just want to challenge us a little bit. One of the things that came out right after the Iraq War was an interview with Karl Rove in the New York Times magazine. And the person who interviewed him, a big feature article in New York was shocked, along with lots of liberals and most of the left. Karl Rove got a little bit cranky at him at one point and said, "You people, you're part of the reality-based community." Well, that's not how it works anymore. We're an empire, and we create our own reality now. And you people can all study that and look at it, but we're history's actors, and you're just going to watch us. And people sort of poo-pooed it and said, well, he's obviously crazy, he's out of touch with reality. But what was significant about that, and friend Stephen Duncombe did a good analysis of it, is that they actually have become very masterful storytellers, and we often get stuck in repeating facts or fact sheets. And I think that has a little bit to do with why the left and liberals are stuck on the defensive, and why right-wing movements have moved forward. So I think there's a challenge to figure out, how do we flip the script and become the people who, you know, who have dreams and can challenge, create narratives, not just attack our opponents' narratives, but create our own compelling stories. So I wanted to thank again all the independent media makers in the house, and especially thank Indie Bay. So I'll say, make media. Will you say make trouble? Make media!
Make trouble!
I can't hear you. Make media!
Make
media!
Make trouble!
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for a minute so we can answer some questions. We have about 10 minutes for questions. And we are running half an hour behind, but we're going to use that full 10 minutes for questions because I know y'all have a lot. So speak loudly. And we've got one back here from a raging granny. Okay. Okay, Gail wants to know about how to get a copy. She's really interested in the history and the RAND Corporation. A former teacher who wants everything documented, right?
Give me your email and I'll send it to you.
info@ragingrannies.com. Okay, more questions for David. We're doing good. We want to be able to answer ask these questions. Okay, let's have a comment and then we'll get the question behind you.
I was involved with the agricultural ministerial back in 2003 in Sacramento, where you were at, and I was part of the local organizing committee. And one thing that people didn't, you know, they talk about who started this, and I kept trying to go back who really started this, and that was the indigenous movement. It was the Zapatista movement. I'm glad that you pointed that out. That's real key. I mean, it started even before that, but that was the kickoff of the whole anti-globalization movement, the real crystallization that occurred, and I'm really glad you put that in perspective.
And nobody's going to put this in perspective except for independent media, right? Because corporate media isn't even going to talk about this stuff. So you want to share your thoughts on that? Thank you for that comment. And a question back here.
I was also in Seattle. I wasn't anywhere near as intimately involved as David was, but I was part of the evening's convention. We had about 700 people there. But one thing Seattle showed me, another activist, just like, I heard this thing once, this long-time radical, who commented, do you realize by 1940 that radicals had to have a telephone? And it just didn't work anymore. They lived, even by 1940, they had spread out too much. They were moving too far away from work. They had to have a telephone to function. They couldn't just go there weren't just to do a coal mine and go anymore. Well, now Seattle shows you had to have the internet, and you had to have the old line, and you had to have a cell phone.
And now you have to have a phone that you can get the internet on, too.
That's true.
Yeah. I can't keep up. Are you able to keep up? Because I'm not able to keep up with that.
So my question to David is, like, for example, when I was in Seattle, I had to borrow my National Union official cell phone and my quote-unquote lobby. It was actually for a few hours because it was so essential to contact you. So my question to him is, could you just talk about the technological aspects of Seattle, how streaming video and the internet was essential to that struggle? Because I remember previously we had to buy a demographic people. I remember in the Gulf War, there was one guy who used to pass out leaflets of upcoming political events, the rest of the events in the Bay Area. We're all so appreciative of that. And now that's been dwarfed by any Bay other media. So, any comments you have about the technological
I'm not a techie, but particularly internet and cell phones and other technology amplified organizing efforts, but it didn't replace it. Had there not been people in cities like Portland doing tons of face-to-face teach-ins, meetings, coordinating buses, forming affinity groups, there wouldn't have been an action. So, you know, or with the Zapatistas, had they not spent 10 years organizing in communities and building a base and having, you know, direct democratic decision-making, you know, those communiques that did go out through the internet wouldn't have had AMP. So I think it's that amplification if you have a solid base of real face-to-face organizing, but there's no replacement for that. I was a little bit involved in the election we just won in Richmond, where the Richmond Progressive Alliance stood up to Chevron, the police union, the county Democratic Party, and they won against several million dollars. You know, I don't normally do electoral stuff, but they said, come to your demonstration, David, get your ass out here. And they won against that because they did 4 months of door-to-door and phone banking and built relationships with community organizations. So there's, you know, and that outweighed a couple million dollars being spent against them, almost $50 a voter. So there's no alternative for that.
Right, you can phone bank with those. And but you remember phone trees? Somebody called, and I had to teach the Raging Grannies to forget about phone trees and come into high tech. But David's point is excellent. Technology is nothing without the people behind it who are using the technology. And we all need to thank the unions and everybody who got behind that at WTO. It was the people.
One quick comment there.
Yeah.
Streaming videos from Seattle that post so totally contradict what the corporate media was putting out about the police having to compel to fight for their lives and all that other bullshit. It was really crucial for the public opinion.
Absolutely. Streaming videos so we know what's really happening. And Karen, come up and speak to us. This is Karen, who's also an IndieBay volunteer.
Mostly a former IndieBay volunteer. I wanted to respond to the question about like print media and things like that because they were so much a part of how activism happened before Seattle. Like starting in Seattle, there was always a print project alongside the website, and we had one here called Fault Lines that was like sort of adjacent to IndieBay. Like the two didn't quite mesh completely, and we ended up stopping Fault Lines because it was so expensive and took so much work to put out a paper, whereas with the website it was just kind of like it was all published already. So like, as much as like access to the internet is still a problem for many people, like I now live in a rural area and I have no internet access, it's really, I think, changed things so much. And for me, like I was like 22 when I graduated from college and moved here, so like the IMC started when I was 24. And like, so it's like my whole adult life as an activist outside of school has really had so much to do with the internet.
All right. Well, young enough to be my daughter, right? Okay, any other questions for David? Okay, Gail, a quick one. Okay, she's going to speak from the viewpoint of an older activist. And we're talking about the environmental and social justice movements coming together.
Well, yeah, it seems like prior to Seattle, from my experience, those two communities didn't interact and didn't seem to trust each other very much. The environmentalists were viewed as elitist. And it seemed like with Seattle, the two communities really came together. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you perceived it that way and what the consequences were.
Right. Environmentalists were Sierra Club hikers and things like that, right?
You don't actually, yeah.
I mean, I think that's our job as organizers and media makers to try and find political spaces where we can bring together different sectors and movements. You know, we're stuck in a country where no one sector or movement or organization has the capacity to take on the powers that be. In those times and spaces where we can find moments of convergence and bring different people together, even people that we don't get along with or don't want to be in the same meeting space with, you know, that's when it's powerful. I mean, there was not a great relationship between the direct action folks and the official labor folks, for example, but the fact that we were actually in the street together was critical. So I think we have to keep trying to figure out spaces where that can happen. I'm involved in climate justice right now, so we're trying to find, you know, how can we bring together lots of different sectors that are all impacted, you know, by this global ecological crisis.
Can we make that enough quote question sound, and then people can talk to David later? Thank you, David. Big hand for David. And Dennis is going to, my co-MC wants to say something here. Yes, I'll tell you who's next. I'm going to tell you first that the workshop is around the corner, opposite the bar. We've got a big video screen there. That workshop will be LAIMC and their retrospective of the 2000 Democratic National Convention. That's with Anna and Chris, who came up from LA to be with us. Around the corner in the back. In this room, and I'm going to let Dennis introduce one of the speakers. In this room from 2:30, which is very shortly, we're going to have race and gender in the media. Dennis is going to introduce Malihe from Voices of Middle East. I'm going to introduce Jean Melisaine because she's my buddy from the South Bay. And also speaking will be Willie Ratcliffe. Willie, are you here? He just walked in. All right, come on up, Willie, from South San Francisco Bayview. And Rachel Jackson of New Year's Movement for Justice, which is about Oscar Grant. So I'm going to have my four speakers come on up. And those of you who want to go to the workshop and hear about the DNC retrospective, time to go on back there. You have just a few minutes to grab something to eat. There's food over here. There's tea. And let's figure out where our four speakers are going to speak. Why don't we have them sit up here? That's a good idea, because they're going to be talking a while. They might want to see. Willie, thank you for coming. And I'm going to let Dennis introduce this crew. But you do have a few minutes for just a few minutes for a bathroom break and to grab some food.
All right. Again, those of you who just came in, I'm Dennis Bernstein here with the Grannies.
Hi.
Really honored nice to be as part of Indie Band Media and the whole independent media movement. I can't even imagine the world before.
Hi, Willie.
I am sorry.
How are you?
But we're going to need it more and more, believe me. And you know what the fourth estate is supposed to be, the checks and balances, and the job of the media, I believe, I've said this before, is to monitor the centers of power for the people, to report to the people, to keep an eye on the military, on the government, on the local government, on the school administration, on the politicians, to monitor the centers of power and give voice to those who are aggrieved, let them be objective about their own realities. That's what it's, that's my objective, is to free the media. You know, we talk about being objective. I am an objective journalist. My objective is to open up the doors and make a platform available so that the community can speak. Should we begin? Yes? Should I start introducing?
Yeah, we can start introducing, but remember there's food here. I can put up volunteers here with food there. The food is free. And the bathrooms are around. Workshop, don't forget. LAIMC came all the way up from the south. We're around the corner here with a retrospective on the Democratic National Convention. And I'll talk to you about what LAIMC is all about.
Are we missing a panelist?
I think Rachel is not here. We have Rachel Jackson in the house. Rachel.
Rachel. Are you here? Rachel Jackson, but I haven't seen you. I haven't seen you since I was dragged out of KPFA 10 years. Where are you, Rachel?
I'll tell you what, I'll let you, because we're going to start right at 2:30. We're going to let Dennis look for Rachel, and the Grannies will sing a quick song, just to get everybody kind of rolling. Number four, if you have a song sheet. When we make peace instead of war. When we make peace instead of war. Oh, how I want to be in that number.
When we make peace instead of war.
When all the truth.
This is a sing-along.
Our home at last. When all the truths are home at last.
Sing-along.
How I want to be in that number. When all the truths are home at last. When children come. Three. Oh. More than three. Oh, I want to be in that number. One children's health counts more than three. And this one's appropriate to this next group here. When we have jobs instead of jails. When we have jobs, everybody, instead of jails. When we have jobs instead of jails, instead of jails. That'll be the day. Okay. We've missing Willie. Willie's getting a drink. And Dennis is looking for Rachel. If you want the workshop, it's around back.